Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
First this morning, India has hit a new record for COVID cases for a fifth day as more and more promises of international aid were made over the weekend. Now, infections in the past 24 hours rose to over 350,000, with overcrowded hospitals in Delhi and nationwide turning patients away after running out of supplies of medical oxygen and beds. Yesterday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged all citizens to be vaccinated and exercise caution, saying the storm of infections had shaken the nation. We'll hear from Delhi in just a moment, but first our reporter Evelyn O'Rourke has been meeting members of the Indian community in Dublin this morning and hearing their thoughts on watching a terrible situation from afar.
Yeah, we are worried in the family back home. My brother, they are elderly, and my sister-in-law are elderly, you know. But we are in touch with them almost every day. There are a huge amount of people here, and I'm sure that most of the people will have somebody either in their village or in their town or in the locality they were living in. They had COVID or they are died of COVID, you know. Because we believe in the extended families, you know. So like the Irish one, and they will know and they will mourn and they will be concerned, you know. That is what is happening.
We are talking to home every day, and especially because I'm worrying about the parents, we asked the family and they said, okay, we are so far all fine, you know. They're more worrying about the getting in the hospitals and beds and admissions, you know, like that. That is make more, you know, kind of, you know, the worry to everyone's like that, you know. But thanks to God now that, you know, the some supports is, you know, coming from that, you know, the from the world and, you know, from the Germany and EU and UK and USA and Ireland itself, you know, part of that EU. So hopefully that's the situation will come to the, you know, soon. And we all be together in this, you know, the situation in the pandemic.
You must feel very far away.
Yeah. And yes, I do. Yeah. And I was getting yesterday from some of my Irish friends, those who are here, and they're also texting me and giving that, you know, the hope and all that, you know, strength, all that, you know, and they were asking how your family, how
so your Irish friends here are supporting you.
Yeah,
here.
Supporting. Yeah, exactly. So really that's make, you know, more, you know, kind of things, you know, we are all part of that, you know, everyone have the concerns about that, you know. So they know that the situation is bad. Everybody, even when I work in the hospital, my patient has asked how the situation in India, how your family like that, you know.
Some of the Indian community in Dublin speaking to Evelyn a little earlier, and I'm joined now on the line from Delhi by Barka Dutt, who's founder and editor of digital platform Mojo Story and also Washington Post columnist. Thank you for speaking to us today, Barka. You've been reporting from some of the worst hit hospitals in Delhi in recent days and weeks. I saw your video last night of a man who was driving his mother from place to place for 12 hours. It really is a desperate situation.
Yes, Claire, it is the kind of emergency that I think I do not remember ever having witnessed in this country in my adult life and certainly in my professional life as a journalist. Everywhere at hospital gates, there are desolate people desperate to get a bed. And in multiple hospitals, the gates of the hospitals are being shut to these patients because the hospitals either do not have beds. And if they have beds, they do not have oxygen. And high flow oxygen is one of the key ways to treat COVID patients. We have seen in the capital city itself at two different hospitals, 25 people die in a single night each. That's 50 deaths just in the last 2 days, not from COVID per se, but from a lack of oxygen. I have also been reporting from cremation grounds and graveyards, and their space is running short. Families are having to wait multiple hours. Ambulances are having to ferry, you know, sometimes four bodies at a time. And Delhi is you know, peaking right now, but I have also been traveling across other cities through India. And everywhere there's a sense of desolation, despair, pain, anguish, but also how we came to this point.
And that's what I want to ask you next, because a tree was declared over COVID in India, as many people will remember. So what has happened since? Is it this variant, or is it the fact that there have been mass congregations?
Well, I would say it's that victory was declared too soon without putting any contingencies in place for the second wave, which experts were warning was coming. So to give you an example, India was exporting and gifting away vaccines to smaller nations, and it was sort of presented as a moment of great national pride. People, including myself, were lulled into believing that perhaps the worst was over, never imagining that that we would be looking at a situation where the jumbo hospitals, let's say 1,000 bed hospitals that were set up in 2020, would have been dismantled, that when the vaccine rollout would start, there would be a shortage of vaccines, that there would be a very tightly controlled rollout. They've now finally liberalized it, but it's been too little too late. And finally, it's been galling to see these mass congregations, whether as political rallies or religious congregations. And we've had a high court tell India's Election Commission today that they should be booked for murder for allowing these political gatherings to go on while hundreds of thousands of Indians are suffering and are literally being treated as orphans of the state.
And you mentioned the shortage of oxygen there. I saw from some of your reports that people are arriving at hospitals with their own oxygen canisters, and there have been calls from some for the army to get involved at the country's oxygen plants to take them over and for the army to control them. How likely is that to happen?
Well, let me put it to you like this. Dystopia has become a cliched word to use for the year that we've all lived through and now are living through here. But in my life, I never thought that outside a hospital, I would see relatives carry, along with packed tiffin boxes and lunch, oxygen cylinders. That is what is happening outside hospitals. As a doctor said to me, oxygen is like gold dust. Everybody wants a little bit of it and there's none to be had. And another doctor said to me, when somebody dies from the absence of oxygen, it isn't a natural death. It is murder. And I think those are the things that we really are trying to internalize. Why are people dying from the absence of oxygen? Why was this contingency plan not in place? Now, in terms of the military taking over, the suggestion has come that the logistical coordination, because what's happening is that every state that is suffering wants oxygen for itself. And we need a centralized way for these oxygen tankers to move. Liquefied oxygen cannot be airlifted, so it has to go by train or by road. It's a cumbersome process, often over long distances. So there has been a suggestion, not everybody agrees with it, that the military, the army should be involved in escorting these tankers as they head from, let's say, the east of the country, where the steel plants of India are, which are now giving out their oxygen, to the west or the north, where the crisis is, Claire, unfolding at this point. And I just want to share one other sort of horrific detail that I encountered in one of my reports. I met a 21-year-old man whose father had died, and he shared with me how, to get his father admitted in hospital, he had to sign what was called a consent form. And the form basically said that if his father were to die from the absence of oxygen or a ventilator, it would be no one's fault. Now, this is not consent. This is people who are helpless. They're desperate. I actually described it as a modern-day death warrant in my column for the Washington Post, because that's what I think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think there has to be accountability for what's happening.
And have you been speaking to the medics who are having to make these decisions and make these calls and turn people away from hospitals?
Well, the doctors I've been speaking to, some of them have broken down in tears. We've had doctors on my program fold their hands and beg for oxygen. Some have gone to court to try and get the courts to intervene. We've had multiple doctors break down, and then they feel even more hurt, because what happens is that when patients or their families get angry, they don't know where to take that anger, so they turn it on the hospitals or the doctors. And it's not the fault of the medics, right? But the medics are very clear that the absence of enough oxygen means rejecting patients. It means a different line of treatment in ICUs. It means, for example, that you can't give someone a high-flow cannula if the patient were to need it, because that's an oxygen guzzler. Mm-hmm. So medics are no longer free to administer medicine. Their choices are being restricted in saving lives.
And we are told here that Ireland, along with the European Union, will be sending help. But surely it can't come soon enough.
Yeah, there's some sense that things are going to get a lot worse before we can hope for them to get better. And while we have a vaccine program for everyone above 18 rolling out on the 1st of May, which so many of us were asking for from much earlier, and we were told it was not possible, there's a sense and a panic that there may not be enough vaccines when this program rolls out. There's a sense that perhaps, we might be preparing ourselves better for a third wave, and we may just have to live through the second wave. We don't know. It depends on how fast now we can get large chunks of the population vaccinated.
And how do you see the official figures when you hear about infection and death rates? It's often said that they're not correct, that in fact those numbers should be much higher. What do you think?
Well, I can tell you that I've been reporting from cremation grounds and graveyards. And in fact, there's a pretty strong right-wing online campaign to try and stop journalists like myself who are doing that. They're citing all sorts of reasons that I don't agree with. But the biggest reason to keep reporting from funeral sites is it's the only way to find the gap between the official data and what's actually happening on the ground. So let me give you an example. At one cremation site, when I was there, I honor 20 bodies, but the entire district that day reported 8 deaths. At another cremation ground, the undertakers told me that they had cremated 100 bodies that day at that one site. That entire city reported 78 deaths that day. So we're seeing gigantic gaps between what the official tabulation is and what the undertakers at cremation grounds and graveyards are telling us. And a lot of people, including expert virologists, believe that the data is underreported and that it is skewed. And in some cases, it may even be manipulated. So things are bad, but they're in fact, they're probably much worse.
And this is likely to have implications for people in India who wish to travel, who wish to leave India, because we believe that India is going to be added to our red list of nations. So people travelling to Ireland from India will likely have to quarantine in a hotel for 2 weeks. Is that causing difficulties for families? Because other countries, not just Ireland, will be doing this if they haven't already done it.
Well, of course, because we have to understand that in the globalized world, families are separated, you know, whether it's your closest friends or your lovers, your partners, your parents, your siblings. We all have somebody we love who lives in another country, right? And for us to not be able to maybe access them, or for them to not be able to access us, is something that hurts. But we understand that it has to be done for now. We understand that it's a medical reason, not a discriminatory reason. And we would like to turn our focus back on just getting as many of us vaccinated as soon as possible. So hopefully these kind of lists can be lifted.
I want to ask you about a tweet that I saw you released about your own father. He has COVID-19, is that right?
Yes. In fact, he's quite gravely ill. One of the toughest decisions that I had to take was whether to put him on a ventilator or not. I had always thought I would opt for no, but when that moment is upon you, you do everything you can to save somebody you love or try. So my father's on a ventilator right now, and I'm praying hard. And when I went through what I did with him, I called it the news coming home, because for days before that, I was the journalist telling the story of other people going through this trauma. And then there I was living it, and not just the personal trauma, Claire, but also the trauma, despite my relative privilege as a journalist and knowing people. When I had to organize an ambulance for him, there's such a crunch for ambulances that the ambulance we got was really a repurposed old rickety car. And when we took him to the hospital was an hour away. The cylinder in the hospital was a single cylinder. There were no paramedics in the ambulance. There was just the driver. And as we snarled through traffic, there wasn't even a green corridor for this ambulance. The cylinder and its mask did not work as it should have. His levels plummeted, and he had to be taken straight into ICU, where he is battling for his life at this moment. And so for me, it was like becoming the story I report. It was surreal. But yeah, it made me living every day.
It's very, very difficult to go through that as you're working and as you have a journalist's eyes on this story, but also have that happening in your personal life with your own family. It must be incredibly difficult.
It is. And there are days when, you know, you just want to stop and not do more, because in your work, all you're seeing is death and desolation and counting bodies and seeing despair and pain and rage and fury. It's not like your work is taking you away and giving you respite, but I feel like I must keep telling this this story in the way that it's unfolding, this crisis, really, this calamity, because despite the pain I feel at a personal level, whatever is happening in India is so gigantic. It's bigger than all of us. And to lend a voice to it and to give voice to others is, I think, what my father would have wanted me to do.
Well, we appreciate you speaking to us and we wish you well in the coming days and weeks. Barkadot, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.